So my first introduction to you, John, was following a talk that you gave at the Action for Happiness event in London.
At the Friends Meeting House there, right?
Yeah. And so I didn't attend that event because I didn't know about mindfulness and I didn't know meditation at that point. But my co-host, Anne, who's a maths teacher, who'd been introduced to mindfulness through one of the MBSR programs. So thanks to you. And he told me about this mindfulness, and I was like, you know, well, what is mindfulness? And I thought that I understood the concept. Now, in the Q&A section at the end, Anne asked the question.
My question to you was regarding the London riots of 2011. And I said, you know, if you could perhaps pass on a message to... Because at the time when I was teaching at the college, this particular college was at one of the scenes where the riots took place in London. And how perhaps mindfulness could change their worldview. So I asked you if you could perhaps think of a message. What would you say to them if you could say something, you know?
What did I say?
All right, so one of the amazing answers that you did give to us, John, was that we should reach out to the Mind Body Awareness Project, you know, in Oakland, California.
Right.
Because they deal day-to-day, you know, going into the prisons and dealing with at-risk youth, incarcerated youth.
And did you do that?
We reached out to them. So we spoke to Sam and Micah, and they were amazing, you know, senior instructors there. And, you know, we had great contact that
I know Sam. Yeah, Sam Himmelstein. Yeah.
Right. And you were the foreword to his last book, right?
That's correct.
A year later, we reached out and we spoke with Roger Miller, the executive director.
Wonderful. I'm so glad you made that connection.
Yeah. So following that first podcast we did with them, it then led me on a journey to find out what mindfulness was. You know, because I scheduled the podcast with them without having meditated myself. But right. Following the stories that they told me and then my research into it, the next 40 podcasts that we did on our own podcast was around the subject of mindfulness and happiness. Which not only became the main theme for our podcast, but the main theme in our lives. So, you know, I just wanted to begin with...
I am to hear that, because, you know, you say yes to giving a talk. You know, I mean, I'm friends with Richard Layard. You never know what's going to come of something like that. So, you know, I'm so touched to meet you guys on Skype.
Yeah.
Basically, and hear that something that I said affected you so deeply that you pursued that thread and it's affected your lives.
Yeah, we try to embody it as much as we can. And with the partnership with Action for Happiness, you know, one of our last episodes got 10,000 hits. You know,
helping others in the London community. You
know, yeah, and help aligns us with our message of how can we help, you know, spread this fantastic message, because,
right.
You know, and I guess what we want to talk about today is not so much, you know, what is mindfulness and the introduction to mindfulness. It's that given that we have meditated and have been meditating for several years now, and the many questions that have come up along the way about the relationship with our own thoughts and, you know, the way that we handle stress and depression and anger, and also how do we live that altruistic life where we thrive? You know, Arianna Huffington mentioned in that talk you did with her about, you know, not only, but thriving. You know, we're here just to not be depressed. We're here to actually be happy. So, John, perhaps can you give us, you know, after hearing that, a bit of background as to, you know, what were some of your major learning points, you know, last year as far as this mindfulness, can we call it a movement?
You can call it whatever you like. Yeah, it's becoming more and more popular, as you know.
Sure.
This podcast is just an example of that. For many, many years, the only people that knew anything about mindfulness were Buddhists and Buddhist meditation practitioners. But in the past 15 or 20 years, interest has been... exponentially rising to the point where it is now everywhere. In the U.S., you can't. Every day you open the New York Times and there's something about mindfulness.
Yeah.
Now, I'm very sort of, I think that's a very positive thing, but at the same time, the more it gets into the mainstream of society, the more easily it could be misunderstood, denatured, or become some kind of hip hype. And that would kill it. Mm-hmm. And so the way to have it maintain its integrity is to remember, first of all, that mindfulness is not a nice idea and it's not a philosophy. It's a way of being. And it involves cultivating a certain relationship with your own experience through awareness. And it turns out that's very hard work.
Yes.
So we're asking a lot of people. We're not asking a little of people when we invite them to, say, take an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction program because they have chronic pain conditions or heart disease or whatever it is. We're saying, no, being human, you have a profound capacity to actually regulate the activity of your own mind and befriend your own experience, even when you hate it, even when it's terrifying, and find ways to be in wiser relationship with your own exact experience. And then that's where health and healing and happiness actually lie. Yes. But I don't want to give people the sense that it's just a commodity that you buy or that some pretense of breathe in, breathe out, I'm enlightened or anything like that. That this is both hard work and really, when you come down to it, the only work worth doing in the world. Because if you're not living in your own experience in the present moment, then you're living in your thought stream in the past or in the future. And usually it's colored by worry or anxiety or perpetual planning. And nowadays also endless self-distraction, because you can always like check your messages or do something to kind of avoid being in the present moment.
Yeah.
So this is a very, very big challenge for all of us. But the fact that it's so popular nowadays means that in some sense, people are starving for this. That we literally are starving and maybe you could even say dying for this. And with everything that's going on in the world of terrorism and everything else, there are certain kinds of diseases that the human species is experiencing now globally where you know, some people are so upset and so angry and feel so alienated that they're trying to kill other people to make the point, look how much I'm suffering, look how much you've caused me suffering without even knowing that you've caused me suffering. And many people don't. Mm-hmm. And so there's never been a more important time on the planet for mindfulness to really become global, but to become global in the deepest and most ethical and most heartfelt of ways. And that has to do with a deep desire to actually be of benefit in this world for other people, not just for yourself.
Yes.
So, and I think Action for Happiness has that as part of your DNA, does it not?
Sure.
Yes, it does, yeah. And I know Chad Meng at Google, who wrote a book, and his sort of secret plan
was... Yeah, I saw him last week and the week before.
Yeah, you know, to bring about world peace. And, you know, given what you've said about the current state of affairs in the world at the moment, do you still hold on to the hope that, I mean, that's a big ask, world peace and, you know, to change the world through one movement. But of course, we've got to, you know, how optimistic. I know that there's research that suggests that mindfulness does bring about greater compassion and empathy, etc. Do you have, you know, a hope in that direction, you know, in terms of...
I don't have a kind of unbridled hope, but I believe that I have a kind of realistic hope and aspiration for humanity. Because what is the alternative?
Yes.
If you think about it for a moment, the alternative to all this crazy, you know, is just more and more of this craziness until, you know, the people who want to cause harm get a hold of nuclear weapons. Dirty bombs, anything, you know, just also to, like, when, you know, that kind of mind is unbelievably toxic.
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, we don't have any choice at this point in the moment on the planet other than to really recognize what's deepest and best in us as human beings, as a species, not as French people or English people or Americans or Syrians or Iraqis, but as human beings. Yes. And instead of turning the other into a less than human that we can then destroy because of all the things we tell ourselves about how much they're to blame for my suffering, that we understand suffering and the nature of suffering in an entirely new way, mm-hmm. and develop wisdom, the wisdom that we're capable of as human beings, that doesn't take personally things that are not personal, and then works for the benefit of all beings, so to speak, by putting your shoulder to the wheel in ways that make the society a more equitable, a better place where everybody can feel at home and not just say the wealthiest people in the society mm-hmm. and everybody else is hurting. Now, if you look at the political scene in the U.S. at this time, you can basically feel, even I'm guessing from the U.K. or from afar, how the whole thing is kind of, you know, sort of exploding and splitting apart. And there's so much implicit and explicit racism and hatred and disregard for the other. And, you know, that is not really tenable. And it's not a kind of credible way to conduct the life of a country that takes care of its own inhabitants and that also cares about its relationship with you know, other human beings in other countries in the world. So this is being played out on a colossal geopolitical scale at the same time that in our own private meditations it's played out on an individual scale or in our families on a family level or in our institutions and workplaces on that kind of a level. So there's no place in the society where mindfulness couldn't actually serve as a kind of Archimedes fulcrum to rotate ourselves, allow ourselves to rotate in awareness, to rotate in consciousness so that we see things as they are instead of believing in our own, you know, self-generated delusions and propaganda, which are often driven by greed and hatred. So it's not just everybody else that's being driven by greed, hatred and delusion, but we ourselves. And when we come to terms with that, when we recognize it in the meditation practice, in how we live our lives from moment to moment, then we can make room for other people in a way that is open-hearted, and then begin to name the ways in which we need to actually undergo that rotation for the benefit of our own well-being and health, and also for the benefit of the world. I take that incredibly seriously. And in fact, my book, Coming to Our Senses, which is now, you know, was written in 2004, so it's 11, 12 years old. It's got 100 pages in there on mindful politics. Because this is not just a matter of sitting quietly in a lotus position and, you know, pretending you're a statue in the British Museum.
Well, how motivated or how much encouragement do you get of where, I guess, the trajectory of mindfulness is going, you know, compared to where you began, where you didn't have science to back you up,
yeah.
and compared to the progress, and you know, like you mentioned, Time magazine, right. You know, you can't open up a newspaper nowadays or click on a website
without
some mention of mindfulness.
Right.
Does that give you great hope?
Yeah, it's because of the science. Let's be clear about that. And I'm trained as a scientist, and it was very much a part of my strategy from the very beginning to not actually only offer meditation within the mainstream of medicine, but to actually document what the effects were on people. Mm-hmm. In other words, to do science on the effects of fairly intensive and rigorous mindfulness practice in people who would never dream to think of themselves as meditators, but who were suffering with chronic conditions of all kinds. And 37 years of mindfulness-based stress reduction, first at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center and now all around the world, have accumulated enormous body of evidence that this stuff really can change people's lives, and that one of the mechanisms through which it changes people's lives is that the brain actually changes when you start to relate to experience in systematic and repetitive ways. And that capacity of the brain is called neuroplasticity. And it now is understood that the brain is actually an organ of learning. And it goes on one's entire life. And part of the way it does that is by changing its electrical activity on the basis of experience. But another way that it does that is actually by restructuring what the neuroscientists would call its real estate, its structure, and its connectivity, so that the kind of practice of mindfulness, for instance, could actually restructure, and there's lots of research showing this now, connections in the brain to strengthen certain ones and attenuate other ones, so that you actually do cultivate greater insight, greater equanimity, greater kindness, greater compassion, that these are sort of biological phenomena. Mm-hmm. And it's a tractable, learnable kind of thing. So now you ask me, well, how happy am I that that's come about? Of course, I'm very happy that it's come about. As I mentioned, it comes with its associated risks, because whenever anything becomes really popular, there's a tendency for everybody to jump on the bandwagon and not understand what it even is. Mm. But you have to use the word mindfulness now just to seem like you're au courant with what everybody else is talking about. Yes. But what about actually cultivating it in your own life? And as I said, that is serious, and it involves a certain kind of interior sustained discipline over days, weeks, months, years, decades, and basically your whole life. And if we go that way as a species, then I think that's going to be up to the task of healing the planet, not just healing ourselves. Mm-hmm. And if we don't go that way, I don't think we even want to think about what the possible alternatives are, because when the human mind, when it gets seriously inflamed and is driven by greed, hatred, and delusion, the levels of suffering that it causes, just look historically, are unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And we can't afford to have millions and millions and millions of people die to get the message that we're fundamentally beautiful and okay, and we need to take care of each other and not just ourselves. Yeah. And we need to take care of the other creatures on the planet and the planet itself, because that's where we get our oxygen from, the trees. And that's where we, you know, we get our water. And if the water is polluted, you know, and our cities, you know, if the glaciers and the ice caps all melt, and we know this is happening, and we know that we are the cause of it, if our minds aren't capable collectively of transforming that in some way, and they say time is very short to be able to do it without wreaking consequences none of us want to talk about, 3 or 4 or 7 generations down the pipe, then we really need to discover what it means to be truly human and to align ourselves with deep wisdom and deep compassion. Mm-hmm. And nothing that I know of, except mindfulness, is a kind of glide path into it that's been well worked out over thousands of years. So this is not something I made up in the basement of the UMass Medical Center in 1979. But how we apply it in the modern age, it's an ongoing evolution. It's not all about going back to the time of the Buddha or anything about like that. And this is not about becoming a Buddhist either. I am not a Buddhist. Mm-hmm. I'm a serious student of Buddhist meditation, but I don't identify as a Buddhist, simply because I think it's enough for me personally to just identify as a human.
Yeah.
And if I were to identify as a Buddhist, then people would think that maybe I had an ulterior motive of teaching other people meditation, so secretly turn them into Buddhists. Nothing could be further from the truth. So this is not about Buddhism. And even the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist.
Yes.
It's about a deep core human wisdom that the Buddha, think of him as a scientist or a great doctor, and he's spoken of in both those ways, had deep insights about the nature of mind, the nature of suffering, and how to we liberate ourselves as an individual and as a human beings, as a species, from that suffering. Yeah. And that to me is universal. It has nothing to do with becoming a Buddhist.
Yes, yes. Just like, you know, like say Newton, who happened to be a Christian, you know, was the father of modern physics.
The law of gravity is a Christian.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't refer to physics as a Christian. It's just a human universal truth.
Because, well, the word dharma, yes, that is describes the teachings of the Buddha means lawfulness. Mm. And, of course, what Newton discovered were the laws of physics, the laws of gravitation. Again, lawfulness. So it's just the way things are when they operate in a certain kind of lawful way. So if you grasp onto something, for instance, one of these mindfulness teachings is that the more you grasp and self-identify, the more suffering you will generate for yourself and for other people. So to bring awareness to grasping and clinging, which is the kind of root cause of addiction, and to be able to open and not cling when you feel the impulse to cling, that's wisdom. And if you keep practicing that, if you exercise that muscle, then you can free yourself from all sorts of habitual addictions, not just drug addictions or alcohol, but from the addiction of busyness, for instance, or the addiction of self-centeredness. And the amount of harm that is caused by that kind of clinging is enormous. So this has, again, it may have been discovered and extremely beautifully articulated in Buddhism, but when we teach MBSR, we're not teaching Buddhism, sure, but we are teaching that lawfulness. But in modern ways that regular people can understand and can enact and embody in their own lives.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to
talk. Is this making sense to you?
Oh, buddy? Very much so, yes. On your point about the addiction to self-centeredness and sort of whilst the modern day technology, the tools that we have has enabled this conversation and you know, it has brought about so much.
You're sitting in the UK and I'm sitting in Massachusetts.
And we're having a wonderful conversation. And at the same time, it's also a tool to feed this addiction of self-centeredness amongst the young in particular, where you know every meal, every occasion has to be sort of backed up with a selfie, a photo, just to, you know. And I think that there's some concern that in that area that needs to be addressed, I think, in education.
I'm glad to hear you young people saying that kind of thing. No, because, again, you get addicted to the iPhone.
Yeah.
And, in fact, I know that people designed the iPhone. All those technologies are designed for maximal addiction.
Yeah.
They're really designed that way. And so to liberate yourself from the attachment to always having to check your messages or to find out how many people liked some comment that you posted on Facebook. Mm. Every time you check and people liked what you posted, you get a little squirt of dopamine. And it's kind of like a drug reaction. And you say, oh, this feels so good. And 5 seconds later, you have to check again because you want another squirt of dopamine. And so basically, you become addicted to a story out there in the internet that's not at all true, but that has to do with how do I present myself so that more people will like me and think I'm clever and so forth. And this is a disease. It has wonderful elements to it, but it also has these disease elements to it. And I recommend for anybody who's watching this program and listening to read the last two books by Sherry Turkle from MIT, who studies the effects of the technology on young people and social behavior. The books are called Alone Together, where, you know, you may be connected to the entire world through your phone, but you feel more and more alone and isolated. Mm-hmm. And the other is called Reclaiming Conversation, where, you know, people keep conversation at a very, very superficial level now because they're always busy checking, you know, their phones or Google to find out, oh, somebody mentioned something. You don't keep the conversation going. You check to get information. And there's a very big difference between information and connectivity, or between, for that matter, information and knowledge. And then, and this is more about computers and the technology in general. So we're like a real information society. But what about the knowledge that derives from that information when you understand? And then what comes from that knowledge is understanding. But what's the point of understanding even unless you take it on to wisdom? And what would wisdom be? That would be a much larger apprehending of the actuality of things and how they are deeply interconnected and what causes greater happiness or causes greater suffering. And then to choose, when possible, to tilt things in the direction of greater happiness and well-being and not in the direction of greater suffering and harm. And that's a that's a function of not just merely the intellect. It's a function of awareness itself. It's a function of the heart. So in all Asian languages, you probably know this better than I do, the word for mind and the word for heart is often the same word. So when you hear, when we hear in English the word mindfulness, if we're not hearing the word heartfulness, we're really not understanding it. We're turning it into some kind of cognitive operation instead of understanding that it has a vast number of different dimensions. We don't understand awareness from a scientific point of view very well. I mean, or sentience would be another way to put it. But, you know, this sort of, this is a kind of miraculous gift that we have as human beings, and yet we don't know how to live inside awareness without being caught in the addiction and in this thought stream and emotional reactivity. And that's where the mindfulness actually, you train to actually shift your default mode from one of constant thinking and being lost in thought and self-distracted to one of being present with no agenda other than to be awake. Yeah. And then trusting that all your intelligences, plural, will come online and be more available to you for whatever is most appropriate in the present moment, whether it's to act or whether it's to be still and simply be present in silence.
Okay. So you mentioned in some of your previous interviews that we as a society, we do not examine the I enough.
Yeah, the personal pronoun.
The personal pronoun. And so, you know, what Anne's explained to me, and, you know, after 2 years of meditation, where you're constantly, for my 15 minutes, I'm going to sit there, and every thought that I come in, I want to take a breath, and then almost as if on a screen, I can watch it. And because of that, there's almost a separation that happens.
Yeah.
And that was a quite profound moment for me, where I could, oh crap. So then everything that I've previously perceived about my life and who I am also comes from this same place of, you know, these thousands and thousands of thoughts that we have every day.
Yeah. So perhaps, and you see, who's thinking those thoughts?
Exactly.
And who's meditating even?
Yes, yeah. Are we the person behind the eyes? Are we just
exactly.
sat behind?
Or? So this is really important. And the questions are much more important than the what we would call dime store answers that your mind will come up with. Maybe we don't know. Maybe, you know, and I had one Zen teacher from Korea for many years who stressed not knowing. The mind that doesn't know, but that knows that it doesn't know. That's one facet of wisdom. So that way, you can at least write yourself restraining orders not to do things that are just going to create more addiction and more suffering.
Yes.
And then, well, what will I replace it with? Don't know. Well, stay open.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you'll learn something new for the first time. Maybe you'll see something new for the first time.
Yes.
Maybe you'll connect with somebody fresh in a way that you never thought you could connect before.
Uh-huh.
And then you're starting to learn. And out of that process of ongoing moment-by-moment learning, you're starting to grow. And your ideas about yourself and who you think you are starting to expand into the totality of who you are. And therefore, there's a certain kind of healing that goes on, which is a kind of coming to terms or to peace with the way things are, like you have this face and not that face, or this body and not that body, or this illness and not that illness, or, you know, whatever it is, that we make peace with it. That's the core of healing. It's not the same as curing, but when you embrace it in that kind of way, the body, it's not just the brain that's plastic, the genome is plastic, the chromosomes are plastic, the telomeres that are responsible for biological aging and cell senescence, they also respond to meditation practice in a disciplined way. So there's never been a better time, according to the science, for us to actually dive deeply into these questions of who am I, the nature of self, which is, of course, what psychology is all supposed to be about anyway, and to maybe cultivate new ways of being in wise relationship with experience.
Yeah.
Okay? And then if we don't know exactly, I mean, of course I know that I'm Jon Kabat-Zinn. I wouldn't mistake myself for somebody with another name. But it's just a name.
Yeah.
And so part of wisdom is seeing you know, what's in the name? You know, a rose by another name would smell as sweet. You know, Shakespeare, like incredible wisdom in Shakespeare, yeah. In, you know, social wisdom, emotional wisdom, cognitive wisdom, right in Shakespeare or right in Dante. I mean, it's not something that's only in meditative traditions. I mean, it's like we're talking about the full dimensionality of being human and then how to live with integrity.
Yeah.
And your way of doing it, whoever you are, is going to be somewhat different from my way of doing it and different from your way of doing it. But we can have a kind of mutual respect and regard. And look, the two of you were working together. I'm sure at some point you didn't even know each other. Mm-hmm. And now, like, you know, so you're not you and you're not you. But together, you can do something that probably neither of you could do apart. There's something very beautiful about that. And, of course, that's also true for parents. Like, you know, I mean, that's how children are born. You know, and so there's a huge degree of mystery in all of this. Yeah. But a lot of it has to do with not taking personally what's really not personal. And when we build huge stories around my suffering or my anger or my fear, and then we don't know that that's a kind of, yeah, on a conventional level, it's all true. And it's not my anger, it's your anger. Mm-hmm. But you, since you don't know who you are, maybe your anger is just a kind of habit. Mm-hmm. And it's not really who you are. It's just some kind of silly habit that you've gotten into. Whenever something gets triggered, you react mindlessly.
Yeah.
Or when you feel hurt, then you get sad mindlessly.
Yeah.
And does it help the situation? Never. Never. No. Only never.
Yeah.
So rather than fighting with the way things are or fighting with the universe, you'll always lose. What about befriending the actuality of your experience and learning over and over and over again how to rest in awareness, stay in the knowing and the not knowing, and not necessarily in the story of me, personal pronoun. Because the story of me, no matter how true it is and no matter how wonderful it is, it's just way too small.